Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey,
upgrade listeners. What are you doing July 23rd to 26th?
Well, I know what we're doing.
What are we doing?
We're going to Podcast Movement in Philadelphia.
At the Philadelphia Marriott downtown?
That's the one.
Is this the world's largest gathering of podcasters?
You bet your ass it is.
When are we featured?
Wednesday, July 25th, 1:30 to 2:15. We are going to be speaking
About
how to make a popular podcast.
I'm so excited.
It's going to be very exciting.
It's us and our producer, Levi Sharp.
Will be there on stage with us.
You've heard him in the upgrade of the week. Now hear him
uncaged. Who knows what he'll say?
It's the birthplace of independence, and it's the birthplace of Levi on the mic.
That's right. So come see us.
See you there.
Okay, bye.
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 Thank you. Bye.
Love you. Hey, upgrade listeners. We're taking a little break. We're retooling the upgrade to make it better than ever. It's going to blow your freaking minds. And while we do that, we thought you'd enjoy one of our most popular episodes, which this is. Enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to The Upgrade, the podcast from the team at lifehacker.com, where we help you improve your life one week at a time. I'm Melissa Kirsch, editor-in-chief of Lifehacker.
And I'm Alice Bradley, Lifehacker's deputy editor.
And today's episode is about storytelling. What makes a good story? What makes a good storyteller? How can we use storytelling to communicate better, to sell people on our ideas, to make people like us? To help us figure this out, we're joined by actor, director, screenwriter, author, and science advocate Alan Alda, founder of the Alda Center for Communicating Science and Alda Communication Training, which trains scientists and business people in improv in order to more effectively get their ideas across. He's the author of If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? My Adventures in the Art and Science of Communicating.
The thing that almost all of us do at one point or another in our lives is engage in the curse of knowledge.
We'll also be chatting with Catherine Burns, artistic director of The Moth, the nonprofit dedicated to the art and craft of stories told live and without notes to standing room only crowds worldwide. In honor of The Moth's 20th anniversary, Catherine has edited a collection of Moth stories called The Moth Presents All These Wonders, True Stories About Facing the Unknown.
Because we want The Moth to be a place for Edward Norton and, you know, a cab driver.
And we've got Lifehacker staff writer Beth Skorecki talking with youth services coordinator at the award-winning Shaler North Hills Library in Glenshaw, Pennsylvania, Ingrid Kalfaller. Ingrid leads these incredibly entertaining story times with songs and puppets and funny voices, and she'll have a room full of preschoolers hanging on her every word.
Leave your ego at the door, be as crazy as you need to be and want to be, and choose a book or a story that means something to you.
But to kick us off, Lifehacker staff writer Nick Douglas is here with a guide to structuring any written story as invented by Dan Harmon, creator of Community and Rick and Morty.
Hey, Nick.
Hello. Hey.
Talk to us about Dan Harmon's storytelling structure.
Right. So this has been my favorite thing ever to learn as I try to write, because growing up, I was obsessed with complicated movies that messed with story structure. And I thought that was the cool thing. I wrote a lot of stories that made no sense because I didn't have a basic grasp on how stories work. And this is what Dan Harmon presents. And Dan Harmon invented this in that he distilled it from a lot of mythological and literary analysis, like Joseph Campbell's Hero with a Thousand Faces, which everyone with an English degree has probably heard of at some point.
I tried to read it once.
And how far did you get? I tried once too.
Like maybe 20 pages in.
That's
this isn't as much fun as the Bill Moyers interview.
So those kinds of concepts. but it's a lot less academic, and it's all you need to help figure out why a story isn't working and make it work. And it's especially great because it seems like it's about plot, but it's really about character. So there are 8 main steps in a story, and each of these can be summed up in one word. There's 1, you introduce the character. 2, need, you give the character a desire. 3 is go, send them on a journey outside of their comfort zone. 4 is search, the character adapts to their journey. 5 is find, they get what they want, or they don't get what they want. 6, take, they pay a heavy price for that. 7 is return, they go back to their comfort zone or make a new one. And 8 is change, they're not the same person that they were at the start of the story.
Oh.
If you're having trouble structuring a story, that's an outline you can wrap pretty much anything around it. It's so good that one of the first places Dan Harmon used it was a web series called Laser Fart. It was a surprisingly emotionally compelling story about a man who farts lasers.
From now on, I will be responsible. From now on, I will use these lasers that come out of my butt to protect the innocent and punish the guilty. From now on, I am Laser Fart.
I think the villain in the show was called Robot Dick, and that was his
I like the
power too.
The guy who farts lasers is the good guy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. In a story that everyone might be familiar with, Toy Story, this is from Woody's point of view. This is a character who, he loves his life. He's in a place of comfort. He's in charge.
You saved the day again, Woody.
You're my favorite deputy.
But he gets something that disrupts that. Buzz comes in, and Woody wants to be Andy's favorite
also,
toy again.
There has been a bit of a mix-up. This is my spot, see? The bed here.
So he gets rid of Buzz. He immediately starts to get what he wants, but it makes the toys angry at him.
Didn't want to face the fact that Buzz just might be Andy's new favorite toy. So you got rid of him.
And Buzz finds Woody and pulls him away from Andy. So Woody has to learn to get along with Buzz and to survive without Andy.
I'm lost.
So that he can get back home, having then accepted that he can share Andy with Buzz.
Hey, wow!
What is it?
Woody! Buzz!
Oh, great, you found him.
So all of these steps of the structure inform each other that the heavy price you pay is often what leads you to change when you come home. It's often what allows you to come home in the first place. And that even works in specific scenes. A lot of stories you'll see, especially really nice archetypal stories like Hamlet or The Lion King, which is Hamlet, will, in specific scenes, go through the whole story cycle.
And if we wanted to find out more about this storytelling structure?
Yeah, you can just Google Story Structure 101, and you'll find where he wrote it out on a site called Channel 101. Or you can search Dan Harmon Wired, where Wired uses this structure to do a profile of him.
Excellent.
Cool, thank you so much.
I am going to try this out. Here with us to talk about storytelling secrets is the artistic director of The Moth, Catherine Burns. Hi, Catherine.
Hey, Catherine.
Hi. I'm thrilled to be here.
We're so happy to have you.
Yay.
So for the uninitiated, what is The Moth?
Basically, they're live storytelling shows where we invite people from all walks of life to come tell true personal stories from their life on stage, always recorded in front of a live audience. And we record all the shows, and those recordings get turned into our podcast and radio show and books. You know, we have different ways that we put the stories out. But at its fundamental core, it's about people showing up in a room in front of their friends and neighbors and telling stories from their heart.
Tell us about the new book.
So the new book is called All These Wonders, and we're really proud of it. So the book is a collection of stories. It's 45 stories gathered from the last 3 or 4 years of The Moth. And like we'd like to say they're lightly edited for the page. So what we do is we actually take the transcripts of what they said and edit it down so that, you know, we take out the ums and the uhs and the repeats and just clean it up a little, paragraph it out. But basically, we edit it in a way that hopefully preserves the live feeling of it, as opposed to like turning each of the stories into an essay or short story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you have to have a good story to participate in The Moth?
I mean, I sort of think there's two people. Yeah, there are definitely people at The Moth who can, like someone like Jonathan Ames, who was like with somebody who like really came up in the early days.
And afterwards, you know, he would tell me stories of the war, and he would often tell this one story. He goes, one time in El Cid, I was walking along on patrol, and suddenly an electric cable shot me in the buttocks, and I went flying in the air 30, 40 feet. I was flying through the air, but then I landed on my feet like a cat, El Cid. That's how you have to be with balance when you fence, El Cid.
He could right now, if he's lived in New York, leave his apartment and come here, and by the time he got here, tell four stories about what happened between his apartment and here. Like, there's always going to be people who can do that. And people like that have been the backbone of the Moth. But the Moth is all about people who might not be, you know, that perfect raconteur, but who just have had an amazing life experience and who are willing to get up on stage and share it. And one of the things I love about Moth audiences is they're just so welcoming and warm, and they help create that space for someone who's maybe a little shy, someone who's maybe hasn't been on stage since their high school graduation, to get up there and tell a deeply personal story and have it really land. So there's, I think there's room for both at the Moth.
What do you recommend people do who might want to participate in the Moth? How would they prepare?
Well, one of the suggestions we make when people aren't sure what they want to tell is, like, when I first get on the phone with someone who wants to tell a story, but we don't know what story they're going to tell, I'll say, what are the stories that you find yourself repeating to your friends? Like, what are the stories where you're at dinner with a friend and a new friend of theirs that they're like, hey, tell the one about XX, blah, blah, blah. Or like, if you suddenly have a new friend or you have a new boyfriend or girlfriend, what are the stories that you can't wait to tell that person? Because we all have them, no matter who we are. And usually, even if the story might be a little anecdotal, I will find that if you dig into it, there's a reason why that's the story you tell over and over, because it says something a little bit deeper about you. And it was just a tiny bit of mining. You'll be able to bring a little bit of reflection to it and, you know, dig in and like open yourself up in front of the audience in the telling of the events and be able to tell a successful story. So that's where I'd start.
And what does the development of a story look like when somebody comes to you with a story for the Moth?
I start out with the person in person, or else we get on the phone if they, you know, don't live in New York. And we might spend a couple of hours on the phone pulling out their life, like talking about the different things that happened. And sometimes it can be like conversations over 6 months. Like, we might not land on the first call. One of the advantages of us having grown to the degree we can is we have the luxury of investing in, you know, months and years in order to find that right story for that right person, right? So in the old days, it was like a little bit more like, oh, we have a show in 2 days. Who can we cast? Once we determine what the story might be, I will then outline the person's story for them. It's easier for someone to work off an outline that you've sent to them than it is for them. It can be overwhelming for them to try to generate that outline themselves. And we do an outline because I personally try to avoid having the person write it all out. There's always going to be people who want to do that, especially writers. You know, they fall in love with their words and they want to write it out and memorize it. One of the few ways that someone can actually kind of bomb at the Moth is to be too written, too performancey. The second you come out and you're like giving a performance, the audience suddenly sees you as a performer and it changes the entire dynamic. And I find that if somebody gets on the page, it takes me weeks to get them off the page. So I just try to have them tell it from an outline. So then once we agree on the outline, we then get together again and I have them tell me the whole story, maybe glancing at the outline, but following the rough beats. And this, usually they start out 15, 20 minutes when we're going for 10. I lovingly call this the free to suck version, because all I want them to do is just get it out of their mouth once, because the confidence is going to come to them when they see that they can get it all out. We work over the next weeks or months to try to get it down to where every detail that they're putting in, because 10 minutes goes by so fast, really supports the arc of what is most meaningful to them. And the reason we make them practice is just because, you know, we say life is long, but these stories are so short, and you get up there and what most people perceive as 10 minutes is really more like 20, we find. And if you haven't practiced it a little bit, you'll get up there and you'll run out of time. Yeah, one of our, I will say an exception of like they don't memorize it is we encourage people to memorize their first and last lines, because when you first get up there, you'll be super nervous. And just to, if you know exactly where you're starting, it just helps you get over that hump of, oh my God, why did I agree to this? You know, that people often have as they're walking up the steps to the mic.
Yeah. Storytelling has become such a buzzword these days. You know, people who are selling cars are like, I'm a storyteller, you know, because, but we laugh, but there is some utility to being a good storyteller in any part of our lives, right? How does being a good storyteller help people who aren't necessarily going on stage at the Moth?
Can I just say a quick thing about it as a buzzword? Like, just two funny things. One is we had like an institutional meltdown a few years ago when one of our board members went to this advertising conference and the head of the Weather Channel got up and said, what we're really trying to do is tell the story of the weather. And he was like, for God's sake. And it was like this long, a million email with our board of being like, we have to make sure that we're like not in the zeitgeist, because then all of a sudden, if you're in, you're going to be out. Yeah. And how do we make sure we're not out? And, you know, I also just have this dream panel, and it would be me and Sharon Salzberg, who I know you've had on your show, debating which term has become more overused, mindfulness or storytelling. I actually finally got to tell her this the other day. I saw her and she was like, I would win. And I was like, I know that you would. Mindfulness. But storytelling, I think, a close second. But that being said, I think being able to communicate an idea clearly, like, I think it's really easy for people to remember things when they're told in story versus dry facts. You know, you remember that story, and so a point can be made so much better, even in a little short story. I also think that if you're telling a genuine story that really comes from your heart and is true to you, then you're going to read as more genuine, and people are going to have an easier time connecting with you. And if they can connect with you, they are going to be able to connect with what's important to you and what you're trying to convey, even if what you're trying to convey isn't exactly a part of the story you told. Mm-hmm. So there's a way when people come out and they're doing corporate speaking, if they can bring something a little personal to it, they'll draw the audience in, and then they'll have them even as they're talking them through the other things that they're saying that might not be as narrative. Mm-hmm.
So just to go back to the Moth for a little bit, you have the main stage and the Slam, right? Are those
yes.
the two?
Those are like the two main performances. Uh-huh.
And what's the
difference?
Yeah.
Okay. So the main stage, we do about 40 shows a year, and this is where we invite people, you know, hopefully from all walks of life. Each show, it's five people, and we invite them to come and tell a true story from their life. And we actually choose them and get on the phone with them and work with them and sort of, you know, coach them on their story and really curate the show. Like, we know that, you know, we're insane about what the order of the stories is. So that is, you know, we do that about 40 times a year. But then, from the very beginning, there was such a desire for people to tell stories once the Moth took off in the late 90s that they pretty quickly, around 2000, they started an open mic story slam competition. It started in New York. And at this, they announced a theme in advance. Anyone who has a 5-minute story on that theme, on the main stage, is 10 minutes. The slams, you only have five. You come, you put your name in the hat, and the first 10 names drawn get to tell a story. And then in the audience, we pick judges from the audience. But the judging is really done in a spirit of fun.
How do you find people for the main stage?
So there's a lot of ways. Actually, one of the things that, you know, sounds like something you would just say, but has really become a source for us, is we have this pitch line where anyone can call and leave a 2-minute version of a story they want to tell. That you can do it on your computer. You can also just use your phone and call up. And honestly, at this point, we get about 500 pitches a month, but we get some amazing people. And so someone on staff listens to every single pitch. We take it really seriously. One of our most senior producers listens to all of the ones that have been identified. And I would say about one person a month from that ends up on the main stage. The slams are another way. Like, someone will come, and what's funny is, like, we've had somebody come in last at the slams. Then we listen to every single slam story that's told. So it's about 6,000 a year. And someone on our staff is assigned. It's a crazy game to try to keep up with it. And we listen to all of them. And, like, sometimes, you know, we'll just be like, that's an amazing story, and put it right on our podcast and radio show. But another thing that can happen is we're like, there's so much in there. That's an incredible voice. I want to know more about that. We'll get in touch with that person, and then they might develop a story for the main stage, even if it wasn't the perfect slam story. And we get recommendations from all over the place. Like, I can come in and on my phone in the morning, there could be one voicemail that's like, I met Edward Norton. This is like a literal example from recently, at a party, and he's this amazing raconteur, and you have to get him for the Moth. Then someone else will have taken a cab from JFK with a man from Pakistan who has told him an incredible story about their grandmother. And I got his cell phone number, and you have to call him. And we follow up on all of this equally, because we want the Moth to be a place for Edward Norton and, you know, a cab driver.
So what are your tips for being a better storyteller?
One of them is to think about scenes. People tend to sometimes, they'll want to tell stories like in a little bit of an essay, like from the outside. But if you can find a way to make your points and scenes and really take us into the moment with you, especially the critical moments of your story, like, ask yourself, what are the real moments where something shifted for you or where something happened that affected you? Paint a picture of what it looked like to be there. I mean, that's something that will instantly improve a story. Another thing is, like, this is a little bit of an expert's tip, but sometimes if people are having trouble emotionally connecting with a story, they'll be telling the story in the past tense. or they get what we call the yous. So if I was telling a story about my morning, you walk down Lafayette Street, you go up the stairs, you meet the host, you know, see how you're so distanced from it. Versus like, as we force them into I walked in, one thing to do is like to try to tell the story in the present tense. And subtly you'll be much more present in the story. So that's another tip.
I also think when you're listening to somebody talk, you can sort of see where they start to get uncomfortable with owning the feelings that they have about something when they switch to the second person.
Yes.
So they're telling you a story. I walked upstairs. I confronted the guy. You know, when you confront somebody, you start to feel blah, blah, blah. You know, they switch it because they don't want to own. You know, you start to feel angry and you want to hit somebody. Right?
You. Yeah. Right. People often at that moment of emotion will want to switch into the yous, and it can be uncomfortable to try to pull them out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've ever told this story in an interview, but like an extreme case of this, all of us who've been in the Moth forever have like the ones that got away, the stories that, you know, we couldn't quite get. And for me, definitely, there was this woman, Esther, and she was living in the suburbs of London. She'd been interviewed years ago by the BBC, and it was one of these crazy things where I was like getting out of the shower and I just heard a clip. She ended up tracking her all the way down to the suburbs of London. So she was a child on the Kinder transport, which, I mean, I guess if anyone's listening doesn't know, it's where during World War II, there was a desire to get Jewish children. They were just piled into trains and they were taken to the Netherlands or England to try to get them out as the Nazis were circling in. And so she was a child. And her story was she gets on the train. Her sister is on the train originally and then pulled off. And so she's sitting there alone and scared. And there's this 4-year-old boy weeping because he's been, you know, pulled out of his mom's arms. She sits and chooses to go and comfort the little boy. She was like 11 years old. All the children have been giving numbers that indicated what stop they were supposed to get off. So the first stop, they're calling out numbers. She can't find her number anywhere. So she just continues to comfort the little boy. She ends up going all the way to the little boy's stop, which was England. She gets off and ultimately then found her number. And the number said she was supposed to get off at the first stop. And all the little children that got off at that stop died. Mm-hmm. And because she had stayed on and comforted this little boy, she lived. Unbelievably gorgeous story. And so I found her and we sat and we're having tea in her house. But one of the things when we finally started talking about the story, she would tell it, Esther met the little boy. Esther sat down with the little boy. Esther, she could never say me or I. And one of the things we think about a lot of the Moth is like, sometimes like how much time needs to go by before you're ready to tell a story. And the most extreme I've ever met was Esther, because after 70 years, Esther still was not ready to tell that story. It was too hard for her, but it was all the fact that this was like not going to happen. I knew everything by the fact that she couldn't stop referring to herself as Esther in the story.
Mm-hmm.
So I was heartbroken, but I like to tell Esther's story because I think it's so beautiful. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it was still an unbelievable honor to meet her. But yeah, so that's a little bit of a longer thing, but that's like, you know, to an extreme, sometimes you can look at the tense can like show you where someone's at in the story emotionally.
Totally. Yeah. And I think that's a good way to measure what we're comfortable with in our own lives.
No kidding.
When we're investigating our experience, if we can't seem to get close enough to tell the story in the present tense or in the first person.
It's true. And like, you just might not be ready, you know, and like things take the time they take. I mean, my joke used to be, you know, 5 years for a divorce and 10 years for a death. But then a therapist friend actually said it should be the reverse, that divorce is much more traumatizing than death for people. But now what we've just found again and again is that, you know, Tig Notaro, do you guys know who she is? This brilliant comedian who famously, infamously, I would say, walked out on stage hours after being diagnosed with breast cancer and did the most brilliant routine you've ever said.
Oh, my God. It's weird because with humor, the equation is tragedy plus time equals comedy. I am just at tragedy right now. That's just where I am in the equation.
But in our experience, most people are not Tig Notaro. Now, the scary thing for us sometimes is people think that they are. They think that they're ready. That's the hardest thing, is when people think that they're ready, but we think that they need a little more time. Time does, in many ways, allow people to tell stories. But it's much better to wait until you're really ready, because I think forcing yourself into something, you can get up there and there's just a bunch of things that can go wrong when you're on stage, because like the vulnerability of being in front of a live crowd can kind of push the story into a crash. And it's just much better to wait until you're ready to get up there with real confidence and security. You'll be able to go deeper and it'll be a better experience for the audience and it'll be a better experience for you.
When you get up to tell a story at the Moth, you're physically there in the room with people. How do you advise people to hold their body or use their body when they're telling a story?
We don't advise them as much as you would think. I mean, one thing that really angers you is like at the Moth, you always have the Moth anchored down. People aren't allowed to take the mic off and they don't have a live mic. So they have to stay on the mic. And we do that because we find that it really centers their energy. It's funny, in the old days, there was always like the comedian or whatever that would want to take it off the mic. And then we got really tough about this rule when, so DMC, Daryl McDaniels, who's like the lead singer, I guess you say, of Run DMC, the first time he told a Moth story, he did take it off because I'm like, he's the greatest rapper. He basically invented rap. Who am I? And he took it off and like kind of wandered around the stage with a mic. But then the funny thing is we asked him to tell it again for a different show we were doing. And he was like, you know what? I'm going to leave the mic on. You know, like, I want to be like everyone else. And we're like, in a world where Daryl leaves the mic on, nobody will ever take the mic off again. You know, like if like the greatest rapper in the world is willing to do this for us. But what we find is it really helps. People hate it at first. They hate the idea of it. But it really just centers their energy and like all that anxiety. It just kind of flows into one spot and helps them focus. So because of that, you know, because they can't move around that much, we don't direct their physical movements as much. But, you know, we're always about, I mean, you guys can see, the audience can. I'm talking with my hands. There's a lot of hand talking that happens. There's always people who want to grab onto the mic and we're like, don't do that, because, you know, it creates problems with the sound, especially now that we have a radio show and podcast. But the critical thing is more in their head, just try to get them to relax. Like we always say, what the audience wants is to just see the purest you that you can bring. And if you do that, you'll succeed.
What makes a story fall flat?
I mean, at the Moth, really about the only way you can fall flat is to be over-rehearsed and to be, and by over-rehearsed, I mean memorized, and to treat the show like a performance. Stand-ups can go wrong really easily because they'll just want to get up and kind of do their shtick and they sort of think they know better. And there's something about it, like where they perform and they're coming at the audience instead of it letting be, it sounds a little, you know, la-la, but like an energy dialogue between the two, and the audience just, again, like they subtly will see it as a performance and they shut down and they start judging the person as a performer. And the second that switch gets flipped, it's very hard for the person to really succeed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, our audience would always rather hear from the guy in the Bronx who owns a funeral home, who's maybe whispering his story, than from the cocky, arrogant stand-up comedian who's going to show you how it's done.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just about the only way you can go wrong. I mean, the biggest fear storytellers seem to have is they're going to forget their story. But we always tell them, like, just like, you can just stop, take a moment, and just, the audience will only love you more. That, I mean, the fact that you could forget a whole chunk of your story means that you're real to them.
And yeah, like nothing like makes me love somebody more than when they say something like, I feel really awkward right now, or, you know,
yeah,
I just totally messed up, or, you know, some kind of admission of vulnerability is a really, at least I hope, because that's, I do it all the time.
Amen. Yeah. Me too. I mean, because it's real. You know, it's like we're definitely much more connected to each other through our foibles and mishaps. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not so much connected to each other by our big triumphs and bragging.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like people's, you know, the mistakes we make definitely connect us in the deepest possible way.
Totally, totally. Yeah.
That's another way people can bomb in the Moth, is they want to come tell some braggy story. Oof. Nobody wants to hear that. People want to tell the story about, you know, if you're the World War II pilot, don't tell the one about how, you know, you save the day. Tell the story about how you ran out of gas over the English Channel on D-Day. That's a story coming soon. That's the story everyone wants to hear.
I want to hear that one.
You will.
We've been sharing our favorite Moth stories with each other in preparation for talking with you. And I sent her to, I'm going to say her name wrong, Bokara Legendre.
Bokara Legendre. Yeah, yeah, that's good.
To her website, because I've heard so many stories of the Moth from her that I've loved. The one about her trying ayahuasca.
Oh my God.
My favorite.
So brilliant. Yeah, that was one of those, there were so many people pitching us ayahuasca. You know, it was like a little of a trend for a while. And then when Bobo, we lovingly call her, you know, who's like, is in her 70s, and this very society lady told us that she had gone to the jungle to do ayahuasca. We were like, what? That's who we want to hear the ayahuasca story from, is Bobo.
Yeah, she was the first person I ever heard mention ayahuasca.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
It was like 6 or 7 years ago,
yeah,
maybe?
I was sweating and I was freezing and I was sweating and I was freezing. And then this green snake arrived and it had blue eyes with long mascaraed eyelashes. And it looked at me and it said, I'm going to clean you out. And with that, I turned into a washing machine. And I was the clothes in the soap and the suds. And it went on and on and on. And I was in the washing machine for hours and hours.
She really is a genius. I know that she's been working on her memoir, and I hope that she'll get it out because I just think she's an unbelievable talent.
And I was sharing with Melissa the Craig Chester story, I Am Montgomery Clift.
Yeah, that's a crazy. Like, ghost stories don't usually work, but that's one of our few.
That's a good ghost story.
And she calls me out of the blue, and I'm like thinking, who died? You know, and she says, I'm like, is everything okay? And she's like, well, this really scary thing happened here last night. I'm like, what? She's like, well, I woke up and there was a man in my bedroom and I thought it was you. He looked a little bit like you. And he said, he wanted me to tell you something. And I'm like, what? And she's like, he was kind of mumbling. And he said, my name is Clifton Montgomery and you need to tell Craig to hurry.
Yeah. We were like, this is the one. Uh-huh. You know, we always have things like certain categories of stories that don't always work, but then there's always one that then will.
Tell us about your work with the international community programs.
So this is one of the major ways the Moth has expanded in the last few years, and we're really proud of it. So it started out, we were working with the Aspen Institute. They have a program where they call them Aspen Fellows, and people apply from all over the world. From my understanding of it is that most of the Aspen Fellows, they are the heads of NGOs. They're often people who are born in the country that they're trying to help. So the idea is if you can provide resources for them, they can then go back to their home countries and make things better for their own people. And so the Moth got involved and started coaching some of these Aspen Fellows because often, you know, they need to get up and tell the story of their business. And often, you know, the story of their business is the story of them. And so now we actually work directly with the Gates Foundation, and we've been doing workshops mostly in Africa. Like, we focus the work like all over Africa. And so the grant we have with Gates right now, the focus is on women and girls. Because who are just often, you know, as you might guess, you know, the voices that get put down, and we're trying to help them, these women, find their voices and rise up. Mm-hmm. My favorite story of the last 2 years was one of these stories. This woman, Sasanke, told this absolutely gorgeous story about learning to listen, how that sometimes the best thing you can do is just listen instead of trying to fix everything. She was a fixer, which I relate to.
Right.
Yeah. She's so good. And Prudence, the woman in her story, it's all about her friend who was HIV positive at a time when it was really like, so like nobody wanted to be around you. You were in South Africa if you had AIDS. And so her relationship with Prudence, and Prudence actually just died a month ago, or like in the last few weeks, there was an email from Sasanke. So one of my favorite things about my job is the people I've met who have died, who I would have never gotten to meet, but I meet them through the stories the people who love them tell about them. And Prudence is definitely one of my favorite people of the last few years.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
And now connecting to us via Skype, actor, writer, director, and science advocate, Alan Alda. Alan, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. I'm really glad to be here.
So tell us about Alda Communication Training.
Well, it's a company I started to help raise funds for the nonprofit Alda Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University, which has been really successful at training scientists and doctors. And we've been doing that for 8 years. We've trained 8,000 scientists and doctors in that time. But the demand is so great now, we need more resources. So I started a company that hopes to teach communication in corporations. And all the profits that we make will go to the Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook. And our first project is for women in business.
Oh, great. And tell us about that.
It's to help women have tools to exercise the power that they have and what they have to offer, which is often held back still, amazingly, after all these years of enlightenment. Women are still telling us, they're still being interrupted at conference tables. They're still having their ideas appropriated by other people. There are still blocks to entering the ranks of leadership. Mm-hmm. But until the culture changes, what I think we can do to help is make communication more effective so that there are tools at the ready when things like that happen that are holding those of us who are women back.
Can you just talk us through a little bit how you do that with women in business?
We do it the same way, interestingly, as we do it with scientists and doctors. What we start with is something fundamental. You need to be able to contact the other person in an intimate, personal way so effectively that you can pretty much tell what they're thinking and feeling. In a way, you can read their mind. Not in a woo-woo way, but in a way that relies on getting information from their face, from their voice. Essentially, you can tell how what you're saying is going over with the other person.
Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't matter how good your message is. If it doesn't land on the other person and isn't incorporated into their thinking, if they're not feeling good about it, it's not really communication. It's not happening. And in order to achieve that, we start with teaching exercises derived from improvisation. And this is not improvisation to make you funny or to make you an actor. It's improvisation to help you connect. Because the basis of improvisation and the basis of what I found in my life as an actor is connection to the other person, responsiveness to the other person. And interestingly, we found that the person who's trying to communicate something has to listen better than the person who's being communicated to. You have to listen for the signs, look for the signs of how they're receiving what you're saying so you know if you're on the right track.
What might one of those improv exercises look like?
One of the most basic ones is called mirroring. I would go through some set of motions with my body. I don't know what they're going to be. I find them out as I do them. But your job is to be my mirror. As if I'm looking into a mirror and there's no lag time. You have to mirror my motions physically as they happen. And you learn at least a couple of things from this. You learn that it's my job, if I'm looking into the mirror, it's my job to help you follow me. And this really has basic application in a moment of communication. If you're not following what I'm saying, it's not your fault. Mm-hmm. It's my job to help you follow me.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing that you learn is that it is possible to be so connected that you have a different relationship with the other person. You're mm-hmm. talking to them as though you're really talking to somebody rather than just saying what you plan to say. And in fact, what you plan to say might change. It ought to change if you see that there's a better way to put it for them to understand it because you're monitoring them as you talk to them.
Aside from not listening to our audience, what do we get wrong when we try to communicate arcane ideas?
The thing that almost all of us do at one point or another in our lives is engage in the curse of knowledge. The idea is that it's good to have knowledge, but you're cursed by your knowledge when you forget what it's like not to be naive about that knowledge, not to understand it in the first place. If we think, since I understand it, naturally you understand it too, that's being cursed by your knowledge. In fact, almost everybody has jargon in the profession they're engaged in. And in the workplace, we develop a private language. You have to really act as if they're not going to get technical terms. You have to be aware of your own secret language and break it down for the other person.
Tell us about the Flame Challenge.
The Flame Challenge is a contest I started about 6 years ago because I wanted to give scientists the experience of explaining something pretty complex to an 11-year-old and see if they could do it. And the reason I picked 11-year-old is that when I was 11 myself, I was fascinated with what was going on at the end of a candle. What's a flame, I thought. So I asked a teacher, and the teacher was silent for a minute, and then she said, it's oxidation. So now I had two things I didn't know the meaning of. That stayed that way for decades. I thought, I'll start this contest and see if scientists can answer what is a flame and explain it so clearly and vividly that 11-year-olds would be not only able to understand it, but they'd be engaged by it, maybe amused by it. The thing that made the contest really appealing to a lot of people is the 11-year-olds themselves are the judges of the contest. And every year they come up with a new question, and they've been tough questions. What is time? What is color? What is energy? They want an engaging answer, but they want information too. One of the most common complaints they have is this entry is not informative enough. I think that's so interesting. One kid said, you know, it's okay to be funny, but you don't have to be silly.
Oh, he said, tough crowd.
He said, we're 11. We're not seven.
Yeah. I think there's something to be said for applying some of these principles to parenting, you know, to speaking to your kids and trying to communicate with them.
I'm having some flashbacks of my son when he was 11 asking me questions and me just not knowing. It was not the curse of knowledge.
Interesting. 11 seems to be a turning point.
Yeah.
You start to ask serious questions and you want real answers.
Who in the public sphere would you most love to have participate in ALDA communication training?
I haven't picked anybody out in particular, though yesterday somebody pled with me to get 100 members of the Senate to read my book.
I was thinking the same thing.
I thought that was very complimentary, but who's your favorite candidate for better communication?
You know, there are certain people who are working, say, in climate change. You know, I'm sure you've worked with a lot of scientists who are trying to get their messages across, and somehow it doesn't seem to be penetrating as much as it could. So climate scientists, I think.
Yeah. It's very interesting. There's a law, as far as I've read, there's a law in Florida that says that people who work for the state government cannot use the term climate change. Even when they're writing about the effects of climate change, they have to call it inconvenient flooding.
Wow.
So maybe that's a good idea. Say, right, inconvenient flooding. Who wants that? Let's see what we can do about that. Rather than fighting over the term, you have to start where your audience is. You have to know your audience. You have to find out what commonality you have.
I was thinking also on a more personal level of how much we would benefit from doctors getting this sort of training. I just was thinking about when my father had heart surgery, when we would get sort of these updates from different surgeons and different specialists who would come in and tell us pieces, and we wouldn't understand what was going on and what was happening with his progress and his recovery and the kind of lack of skills they had in communicating these things. To talk about the curse of knowledge, they would kind of throw terms at you and then walk away.
Wasn't an experience with a doctor what sort of inspired you to get into this?
It was mainly my experience working with scientists on the television show Scientific American Frontiers that helped me realize we were doing something that was very valuable for communication. We were making this connection because we didn't have a standard interview format. We had an open-ended conversation where I just wanted to understand what they were talking about. And I was relentless. I wouldn't give up until I understood it. I never pretended I understood it. I didn't pretend not to understand it. My ignorance was genuine. It wasn't faked. I had a huge store of it, which I could use, but because I was curious. But it was really not through seeing how bad communication could be, but through seeing how good it could be, how good it could be, that I thought we have something we can teach. I have had plenty of difficult experiences with physicians, just as you described. I remember when my father had a stroke, he was unconscious on a bed in the ICU. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to talk to him, and the doctor said, he's very deep.
Mm.
And I kept trying to talk to my father because I didn't know what very deep meant.
Mm-hmm.
He meant, he's out. Mm. Forget it. You know?
Yeah.
And there were many times when they would talk to me in terms I really didn't understand. And instead of saying it another way, they would just keep repeating it.
Yeah.
This idea that if I know it, you must know it. I just have to say it a couple of more times and it'll revive your memory. You know, it doesn't quite work that way.
Do you have people in your programs that ask you about how our digital communication is affecting our non-digital communication?
Well, interestingly, I'm not aware of anybody taking our courses who asked that question, but I'm asked that question in almost every interview because we all go through that. So one of our instructors made a really good point. If you're writing an email to someone in response to their email, it's a good idea to see how they handled the salutation. If they said, "Dear Sam," then you should say back to them, "Dear Paul." That's an interesting idea that you get in their tone of voice, which is very similar to the rest of what we do. But here you're picking up clues not from somebody's face, but from the choice of words they make, the level of intimacy they want to begin at. I think that's a really good idea.
Yeah.
But I have a positive response a little bit to the brevity of these text messages and emails. I think there's a feeling when we write these very truncated messages, we have a little bit of a worry in the back of our head. Is this getting through the way I mean it? Am I being misunderstood? Which is a glimmer of thinking about what the other person is thinking as you communicate with them, which is the basis of all of this that we've been talking about. And I think a sign that that desire to know what the other person is thinking, a sign of that is that's when we put in an emoji. So rather than bemoan the smiley faces, I think maybe we can at least hold out the hope that that's a smidgen of interest in what the other person is thinking, and maybe we can build on that.
What about communicating in instances where there is conflict, where it's a little bit more difficult, where you don't necessarily have a rapt audience, but you might have a more charged situation? Do the rules still apply?
We have an exercise we do called the rant, where for 2 minutes, you'll rant to me about something that really upsets you, really, truly upsets you. And you're free to scream and stamp your foot and curse, and you don't make it up. It's something that really bothers you a lot. My job is then, hearing that for 2 minutes, is to introduce you to the rest of the room as my friend who has these really wonderful values. And I find from your rant, I find the most positive version of that I can express. So I probably will not be repeating the negative stuff you're ranting, but I'll turn it into the most positive thing. You hear that the person you're talking to understands the positive source of your complaints and can accept them. And you have now something you share. You share a positive attitude toward your complaint. Now, it's not always easy. It's probably always kind of hard. But that's the value of training. It's the value of our workshops. We put you through so many experiences that you can use later, and you're able to use them because you've practiced them. It's a little like if you were going to go play the piano at Carnegie Hall next week, and you'd never taken a piano lesson in your life, I probably wouldn't say to you, "Here's three good tips to remember when you get on stage." You kind of have to go through the process. And you don't learn to ski from reading a book.
That's my problem. I read that book. It didn't work out for me.
That's why in my book that about this, I tried to find exercises that would help keep me tuned up, to help me keep my empathy at a high enough level that I could read other people successfully.
Is developing that empathy something that you developed as an actor?
Yeah, I think you can't be much of an actor without empathy. And I think you can't be much of a communicator without it either. And I think I first started trying to do it before I even paid much attention to the word empathy. I wasn't really crazy about the word empathy because I understood it to mean to be kind of gooey and new agey and to be loving of everybody, you know, just only see the best in everybody. And sometimes you have to use empathy as a tool to combat the other person. If you're in a courtroom and you have to argue against the other lawyer, it's probably a good idea to know what they're going through, but not to use what they say to help them, but to defeat their argument.
know where they're coming from.
Some situations are set up like that. You're not looking for collaboration. You're looking to put on the best show. Mm-hmm. But as an actor, you have to use empathy, if you mean empathy, to understand what the other person's point of view is, what the other person is feeling. Mm-hmm. So I think that, for me, that was the open door. And then I sort of discovered it all over again when I started trying to understand what made communication work better.
Have you had any experience working with people who are neuroatypical? Like, I'm thinking of the kind of cliche that a lot of scientists have Asperger's or are kind of on the spectrum a little bit in terms of not really understanding social cues as much and maybe being a little more challenged with kind of getting that empathy across.
When I was doing the science program, Scientific American Frontiers, I interviewed hundreds of scientists, and I don't think I've found that many scientists who I would have said were on the spectrum. I think that's a stereotype that's a little overblown. On the other hand, the people I did talk to had already been vetted by the producers, and they were always looking for people who could communicate as easily as possible on the air. So I might have had a sample that wasn't characteristic, but I have not come across in my daily life that many scientists who have a real inherent difficulty in communicating. But the nice thing is, no matter how well or how poorly you communicate, my experience has been with this kind of training, everybody gets better. Mm-hmm. I interviewed in my book a scientist who started maybe 20 years ago teaching young people on the spectrum how to get along more comfortably in the outside world through teaching them improv exercises. And it made a tremendous difference for them, because the way he had been instructed to work with them before he started using improvisation was to say, now, when you meet somebody, here's what you do. Wait, let me ask you a question. You hear my wife practicing clarinet?
Oh, that's your wife. We do hear it. It's very faint.
Okay, I'll ask you to go to another room. Hold on a second.
Oh, my God.
Okay. I don't think we'll hear it.
I hate to interrupt her rehearsal. Her breath.
Yeah. He uses improvisation to train them, which is radically different from how he was first told to train people on the spectrum. Mm. The way he was told to do it originally, and the way he did it with a number of high school kids at first, was to say, here's the situation, here's how you deal with the situation. You're meeting somebody for the first time, look them in the eye, shake their hand. Don't look them in the eye too long or you'll freak them out. Mm. So it's a mechanical instruction on how to take care of this interaction. They were so upset at being told what to do in specific situations. He said they were getting angry at him. He was in the middle of a class. They'd start throwing things at him. Huh. So he heard from a couple of actor friends about improvisation, and they helped him develop some exercises. And he went into the class and started improvising. The kids loved it. Hmm. And now they were prepared not just for a handful of specific situations, but they could handle what the world gives you, which is an infinite variety of situations. They had interpersonal techniques that they could bring into play. They could swing with a lot of different situations. Mm. And he's been working for years on this and has had great success.
I think we could all benefit from yes-anding a little more.
Yeah, it's not easy to do.
Yeah,
but it sure can make things better.
Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much. This is wonderful. Well,
thank you. It's very nice of you. I appreciate the chance to talk to you.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
And now, Lifehacker staff writer Beth Skorecki talking with the Youth Services Coordinator at the award-winning Shaler North Hills Library in Glenshaw, Pennsylvania, Ingrid Kalfaller.
So, Ing, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's quite an honor. Thank you.
Let's start with a basic question. What's the point of reading to kids? What should we expect them to get out of the experience?
There are many things that children experience when they hear a story, and I believe that the most important part of it is empowerment. What it does when a child hears a story, it allows their imagination to simply take off. It allows them to learn new language that they can put into use for their own. It gives them power to be who they are supposed to be, and it helps them understand their way in the world and the world that's around them. I think there's nothing more powerful than story for doing that.
So sometimes when I see you read to kids, it looks almost like a performance or a game or a dialogue, and the kids are just super engaged. So can you tell me about some of the ways we can give kids that multifaceted experience when we read to them?
I think the first step in helping to engage a child with story or with a book, whether you are telling the story without having the book in front of you, or you actually have the book in front of you and you're helping them to see the words on the page or teaching them reading itself and modeling that for them, is to leave your ego at the door. You know, like when Quincy Jones got all those big names together for that We Are the World, that was the motto that he had. He said, leave your ego at the door, because he was dealing with folks with pretty big egos. You need to really humble yourself and act as goofy as you can and just give everything you have to the child that you're interacting with. But the thing is, that's not really hard to do, because you're going to want to do that. Leave your ego at the door, be as crazy as you need to be and want to be, and choose a book or a story that means something to you. It can be a book that everybody else in the world has panned and says, this is horrible, this is awful, this is terrible. If you like it, you are going to convey that. Be genuine and honest and be yourself as deep as you can be. And that's going to come across. And that right there is going to start to build that connection.
Muffin, right out of there. How many are left now?
Zero.
There were zero little muffins.
Yeah, and kids are never going to say, like, oh, you're being too goofy, stop it.
Oh, no. Kids are never going to say you're being too goofy.
No.
Right.
So tell me about going off script. Like, so sometimes, you know, like you could stop and ask the kid what's going to happen next or talk about the book. Like, is it good to do that, or is it good to read them through and show them this is how you read the book? How should you handle that?
I think you can do a little bit of both. And I definitely think that it depends on what stage of development that they're in. Everybody develops in a different way. And especially like working at the particular library where I work at Shaler North Hills, we're more into stages, not ages, because, you know, when you're three, yeah, there's some guidelines to look for, you know, but not every three-year-old is going to respond the same way. Not every four-year-old is ready to recognize letters and symbols and that kind of thing. Not yet. You know, maybe some are. Some are going to develop a little quicker. Some are going to develop a little at a slower pace. But if the book is in front of them, what I often do is, if I'm going to read it through once, I'll just read it in a completely goofy way. And sometimes you do go off topic, and that's okay, and that's to get them engaged. But then if I have a purposeful intention of showing them how to read and how I figured that out, I might say, hey, let's go back and look at this page. Let me show you. Remember we were learning about the letter H this week? See that H? That's the H guy. And it's the first letter in the word hat. And so you can intentionally show them that way. So sometimes you can do like a guided reading. There are a lot of resources out there, and we'll have them on our website, shalerlibrary.org, if you go to the children's page, that can tell you how to ask those kinds of questions in a way that won't, you know, be breaking up the flow. But I say the more you share a book with someone, read it once for the party, and then go back the second time, for the more instructional kind of material.
And so sometimes it's the kid that wants to go off script and like you're reading and they want to stop on like the page where the hungry caterpillar is eating the apple and they just want to stick their finger through that hole a million times.
Yes, and that is absolutely wonderful. Even with babies, one of the most wonderful things to do with your child that you're caring for is to, you know, we get tons of catalogs in the mail. Give them a catalog that you don't care if it gets ripped or torn, and they can start paging. These are all those pre-literacy, you know, early literacy things. Learn how a book flips. And if they need to rip that page, that's okay. They're going to learn eventually that some books we rip apart and, you know, some books are going to cost us maybe a little bit if there's somebody else's and we borrow that, you know, but they're going to learn that. And it's developmentally appropriate for a child to tear and to play and allow them to be in that stage that they are currently in. And when they want to go off script, when they want to focus on something, let them do that. When they want to tell you the story, invite that, because that is creativity and that is imagination. And you're creating a little writer. You're creating a little storyteller right there from the very beginning. I mean, I'm sure your kids have already told you some wonderful stories.
Yeah,
you know?
My younger son, I asked him if he wanted me to tell him a bedtime story. I'm just like trying to get him to calm down. And he said, okay, once upon a time. And he just started telling me this most amazing story. And it was sort of cobbled together from like TV shows he had watched and whatever was going on in his head at the time. Yep. So can you back up a little bit and tell me about reading to babies and young children? What are some of those things they need to develop? So like you mentioned that they need to learn that like a book is something with pages that you can go through. And I guess they sort of learn like what a story is. And, you know, because by the time I guess he was 3 year old was telling me these stories, like he had a sense of like they have a beginning and they have to have a problem in them. So what are like some of the major milestones, some of the things they have to like figure out?
So kids are going to pick up intuitively on the rhythm and method of a story, because especially when you're reading fiction, it's going to move like real life. And that's why fiction is so much easier to read and share with kids. And sometimes there's a little bit of problem when they start, you know, getting into the nonfiction in school, especially have to read to learn instead of learn to read. And so I wouldn't worry so much focusing on teaching them the mechanics and the basics at a young age. You know, I think when a child is very little, just cultivating that idea that this is enjoyable, that this is fun, and creating that sense of fun. And this is something that's going to give you power, because the more words you have, the more power you have. And that's why telling a story, you can tell a story when you're walking down the aisle in the grocery store. You can tell a story in everything. You can tell a story about this sock needs his little friend over here. Where's my blue sock? Where is my blue sock? Oh, you're over here. I'm going to go over here with you. You can make everything animated and tell a story at any chance that you have. And that's how kids begin to fall in love with telling their own stories and wanting to hear more.
So tell me about Ninjago books and Disney princess books.
Yes. Okay. You know, there are some people who are of the opinion, I don't want to buy a SpongeBob SquarePants reader because that's garbage literature.
Okay. Or it just feels like you're reading a commercial.
Or it does feel like you're reading a commercial. I know. I mean, especially Shopkins, man, because it is just about shopping, but they are so cute. But the thing is, those, especially with the early books, and you'll see the different books that'll say like level one or ready to read. A sight word is a sight word. And it doesn't matter if Dick and Jane teach you a sight word or if SpongeBob and Squidward teach you a sight word. And if that is what your kid loves and that is going to allow your kid to have pleasure during reading and be interested in finding out what is it that is happening here, what are those connecting words, then you roll with it, because that act of reading and that enjoying a story and that habit of sharing a story and reading a book, it's building. It's building.
So let's talk about diversity and inclusivity in books. So surveys of picture books consistently find that there are more male protagonists than female ones, and people of color are way underrepresented. And if a character is LGBTQ or has a disability, then that book is sort of a specialty item. So it seems like we have to go out of our way to find books that actually reflect the world we live in.
We are diverse. And so we need our literature and our experience, our arts to reflect that. And there are many, the Brown Bookshelf is a great website. We need diverse books, and they're going to have book lists on there that'll help you find those. you could see the kids just eyes go, whoa, that kid looks like me. That kid knows what I'm going through. And so it's really important. There's a great list, and this will be on our website too. It has like a traditional book, you know, that's pretty whitewashed or whatever. And then if you want a diverse kind counterpart to that or something that is like that.
So it's like if you know, if your kid loves this book, then these are other books that would match their interests.
Right. With more reflective of the actual world. Mm-hmm. Right.
Ing, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Oh, what a blessing this was. Thank you so, so much.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
We're back with Catherine Burns of The Moth to discuss our upgrade of the week. Every week, we discuss that one tiny thing that's made a huge difference in our lives. Melissa, what's your upgrade this week?
I'm going totally wireless on my desktop. I have gotten rid of my wired mouse. Yes, I had a wired mouse in 2017 because I'm left-handed and I need a particular kind of scroll with my mouse, but I found one that's wireless and isn't specifically meant for right-handed people. So I have a wireless mouse. I have wireless headphones. I'm waiting for Apple to come out with wireless charging for my phone. I'm very particular about having a clean desktop, and moving to all wireless products. I already had a wireless keyboard, has made things a lot better for me.
Catherine, what's your upgrade this week?
I'm always, as a New Yorker, my purse is just too heavy. And how can I lighten my purse? And I'm always like dragging around a book, and I refuse to get a Kindle. Like, let's not go there. I'm just like, I like my physical books and my physical magazines and all of that. And so one of the things that has lightened my load, especially with reading things like The New Yorker, is that when I'm reading the magazine, I rip the articles I want to read the second it comes out, fold them up, and they go into my purse. And so all I'm doing is actually carrying around the articles I actually want to read. And then when you're in line at the post office and you're bored, whip it out, the little thing. And I've just like really almost double the amount of reading I'm doing on the fly because I always have these articles. But instead of like carrying around these heavy magazines and all these things, I know I can reach in and there's something I've already pre-selected that I want to read right there that weighs almost nothing.
That's not just an upgrade. That's a life hack.
What about you, Alice?
Well, I have long been an opponent of to-do list apps. I've always thought, like, I'm going paper. I'm old school. I like my classic legal pad and whatever. So I would have these kind of like series of pads in which I like wrote down lists of everything I had to do, only I would scrawl them and then not quite understand what I had written. And then I would lose the pad. It was not a good system. And now that I'm deputy editor, I got to take those lists seriously. So anyway, I finally downloaded an app called Wunderlist that I have been really, really enjoying this past week. I'm actually writing down all my to-dos. They're all in one place. There's different folders for different categories of things. I can share my lists with people, and they get a very satisfying little bell sound when you click off the to-do list, to-do
item. You check off that you've done.
You check off you've done something, and it goes bling, and you feel like you've accomplished something. It's very, you know, real Pavlovian
nice.
Response. And anyway, yeah, I'm really into it.
What's it called again?
Wunderlist.
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 I use Todoist.
Yes.
Right. Another favorite of Lifehacker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love it, but I've actually apparently reached like where I have more than 200 items, so it keeps yelling at me. And it's because it just won't let me add anymore.
Because like the ones that
you,
limit.
Yes, I hit it. And even with it, when you pay the paid version, because when you, I use it for like, I put people's birthdays and did it. Mm-hmm. So it's like, that's how it's not just like my actual to-do list is 200 items. Thank God. But if you add up all of the things I have to remind myself year round,
right?
It's been a motivator though. Cause if I really keep up with my to-do list, then I don't hit that limit.
Right.
But I'm now, I can feel it right now. I'm so close. It's going to, and then it won't let you add something.
I'm aghast that you can reach a limit on a to-do list.
So I'm open. Yeah. I'm like, tell me the new, I'll like have to check that out.
Wonderlist.
Yeah. So Wonderlist. I don't know if there's a limit. If there is, I have not yet reached
and
it.
And you're using this on iOS, right?
Yes, it's on iOS.
Great.
And Mac
and
OS 10.
Yeah. OS 10. Right. Thank you so much, Catherine,
Thank
for being
you.
On the show.
That was fun.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show. Come find us on Twitter. You can find me at Melissa Kirsch. You can find Alice Bradley at FinSlippy. You can find Catherine Burns at BurnsyNY. That's Burnsy, BurnsyNY. You can find Alan Alda at Alan Alda. And of course, you can find Lifehacker at Lifehacker. The Upgrade is produced by Levi Sharp, who's on Twitter at Levi Sharp. Our executive director of audio is Mandana Mofidi. Brad Fisher mixed the episode.
Got an idea for a future episode of The Upgrade? Email us at upgrade@lifehacker.com or leave us a voice message at 347-687-8109. And you can always find us on Panoply, NPR One, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Follow Lifehacker on Facebook at facebook.com/lifehacker. And you can find show notes for this and every episode of The Upgrade at lifehacker.com/the show.